All right, welcome back to Prisneyland, everyone. Thank you for joining us. Today's episode is Riots, Drills, and the Devil, Part 2, the thrilling conclusion of our two-part riot extravaganza.
Otherwise known as these episodes are not relaxing.
Not at all.
And today it's you and me, Paul, discussing this, because there's a lot to do.
There's a lot to do. We have some trivia, we have some fan questions, we have a cut scene to discuss, and we have notes from Sarah's original shooting script, because as we have established, she is
a huge dork.
Nerd. Yes.
Or just a pack rat, maybe.
Yeah, I think it's really cool. I have a lot of scripts, but I don't have this one. Okay, jumping into the Callistine Index, the episode aired on October 3rd, 2005. It was directed by Vern Gillum, written by Karen Usher, making it the first episode of the show written by a woman. And Karen would also become one of our show's core writers for all of the four original seasons.
We aired against our sort of now usual suspects. New episodes of Two and a Half Men on CBS, Las Vegas on NBC, as well as Monday Night Football on ABC. This was a Panthers-Packers face-off landing with the Panthers. A lot of P's involved in this. Landing with the Panthers at 32:29. The rating for this episode was up almost a million viewers from
last week.
To 9.48 million. And I do remember that often the ratings didn't reflect the quality of necessarily that episode, but sometimes it was like the episode one or two before.
And also they would show the previous, I'm sure with this one in particular, they showed Riot, Drills, and the Devil Part 1 before they showed this
Probably
one.
Probably leading
could
in,
watch
yeah.
both in a row. Going on in pop culture at the time, on this same day, October 3rd, Grey's Anatomy premiered its second season on ABC. We're very glad we weren't programmed against it. And that show is still on the air. 19 years later.
I think I've been on 5 shows since Prison Break.
Oh, at least. At the box office, Wallace and Gromit, The Curse of the Were-Rabbit? Were-Rabbit?
Wallace I think Were-Rabbit.
Wallace and Gromit, The Curse of the Were-Rabbit was released this week, a film that would go on to win the Oscar for Best Animated Feature.
In global events, this week was the first ever video uploaded to YouTube.
Oh, wow.
It was uploaded by its co-founder, Jawed Karim. Speaking of things that are still going strong.
I think it's a fad.
It'll never last.
It won't last. Rock and roll and television.
In controversy news, this was the week that the Danish newspaper, I don't know that I can pronounce this, Jyllands-Posten, maybe? I apologize to all of our Danish listeners for butchering that.
Maybe a different word.
Ooh, for mispronouncing. Whew, that was tough. Anyway, the newspaper published cartoons depicting the prophet Muhammad. That publication sparked widespread protests and public debate on freedom of speech and religious sensitivities. In other words, this was a huge week, the week of October 3rd, 2005, in tech and journalism.
Back to our little TV show. Here's the TV Guide website synopsis. Conclusion. Bellick cozies up to the governor and his hard line against the rioters. Abruzzi lends a hand in laboring on the escape route. Veronica and Nick get a scare in D.C. when they trace the anonymous call that fingered Lincoln.
Okay, so that's our index. And now for our rewatch. If you want to listen to the whole thing,
yeah,
you can
come watch the show with us. Here's some highlights. It sounds a little like this.
I didn't realize it was going to escalate to such violence is potentially the subtitle of this episode.
I mean,
this is a very smart thing that the writers have done. Given that you've got 8 days to shoot this episode, maybe 9 if you get an extra day, they've broken these massive riot scenes up, which are so difficult to shoot and so time-consuming, into these two-person scenes, which are much more straightforward to shoot.
Right.
And structurally, that's just really smart because it buys us time to do the bigger scenes.
Yeah. I still think Kellerman has the highest body count on the show.
That would make so much sense. I mean, you kill people like every 3 episodes.
More season 2, I think, started killing people. Oh, wow.
Okay. There's a lot going on there.
That is a lot going on in that episode.
We will be right back to talk about the episode.
Okay, welcome back.
We have a lot to talk about. We start, yeah. I actually have a story to tell you from episode one. I discovered this while I was going through some of my old scripts, looking at these episodes. So episode one, not the pilot, but Alan.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a deleted scene between Michael and Sarah in that episode.
Okay.
And I think probably the core of this is that there are three things that I share in common with Peter Jacobson. Phenomenal actor. Number one, we were both on Colony. Number two, yes.
Keep going.
Number two, we were both born at Michael Reese Hospital.
Okay.
And number three, we've neither of us ever had a cup of coffee. Caffeine hits me the way I'm told like a four-day Coke bender used to hit our white male actors in every lead of every movie in the 80s. We had this scene, and I think it was the first scene that I shot since the pilot. It was first up. I have it here. These are my pieces of paper. And we shot it at 6 a.m, which meant I had to be, or around there, I had to be in hair and makeup by about 4, which meant since Juliet was about an hour from my house in Chicago, my apartment, I had to wake up at about 3. So in order to stay awake, I had a half a cup of decaf green tea. I know, dude. I am so rock and roll.
Oh my God. I'm literally drinking my third cup of coffee in like the last 20 minutes.
And it's 10:49 a.m. Mm-hmm, I know. Mm-hmm. I'm a super, super, super lightweight. So, and I'll give you the broad strokes of the scene in a minute, but a couple days after I shot that scene, one of our producers, I think it might have been Gary Brown, took me aside and was like, hey, is there anything that you need help with?
Come on.
And I realized over the course of this conversation that they were concerned that I had a
cocaine
drug problem, and that they cut the scene because I was so jittery.
Come on.
So, moving on, that was the...
strange story.
That was the very amazing. Strange story. There is a deleted scene out there somewhere with me shaking and apparently in weird makeup.
Wow.
Yeah.
This episode is really something. And, you know, I always think in... I asked during the rewatch, did they shoot it all as one episode? And the answer is no, because there are two separate directors, two separate scripts that they did not integrate. That there's a lot of like, okay, we had 15 police cars here and all the guys in the army gear and da-da-da. And like that was not all shot on the same day. They had to go back, match mm-hmm. everything to the previous episode, like the riot stuff. Like they had to get all the geography right of everybody, you know, in the same spot so that it all tracked. And that must have been quite an undertaking.
I wonder if there were some scenes that they like for the riots, I wonder if they did that day 8 of the first episode and then started on day 1 of the second so that there was at least a sense of, hey, everybody remember where you were yesterday.
Right.
That kind of continuity. By the way, we also hear in these episodes T-Bag's full name for the first time.
Yes.
And again, dorkishness. As I discovered in my original drafts, it was not at first Theodore Bagwell. It was Timothy. That's apropos of nothing.
And we still have to get to the bottom of, if you will, T-Bag and how that snuck through Fox.
We do. That's a writer question.
Yeah. I was reminded when they're on the plane to DC how much I love those sets when they what they actually do is they have a piece of a plane. They have about, I don't know, 30 feet of a plane that they've, I would imagine, gotten from a junkyard or something or bought from somebody. And then,
yeah, maybe Boeing has an aftermarket.
Yeah. And they put it on set and you feel like you're in an airplane. And it's just one of those movie magic things that I still just can't seem to get over.
It's so cool. It's so cool.
Because you're like, what is this plane doing here?
Like, wait, it's for us. It's just right. for us.
And it looks not just to like mention, a plane.
It's also one scene. I mean, it gives you a sense of the scope of the show, right? It's not like they're shooting eight scenes and
it has
it all
massive.
Day.
It has. I don't think it's terribly expensive, and it has massive production value. Although you do have to shoot. I don't know what they did here. I think they just blew out the windows with light. But, you know, you do have to
the put green screen
something
of it all.
Out there.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You sure do.
Unless it's night. Which then I guess you just need to do twinkle, twinkle.
Yeah. But you'd still have to have the sense of motion, which is...
I don't know. Do you?
Well, there'd be movement relative.
Okay.
Right? In theory.
I don't know.
I'm not sure. I am not... This is not a
this
department
is not
that
the
I'm
DP episode.
I have a question for you. When we were doing... when we were doing our rewatch, I made a note that said, Paul-injury rule.
Oh, I know. So we were talking about storylines and being on kind of different shows. That there's so many separate plot lines. And in season one, I don't think I certainly didn't have any scenes with you. I didn't have any scenes with on our own little shows. And I sustained some injuries in an upcoming episode. For instance, like a broken finger.
What?
Not me personally. My character.
Oh. Okay.
I think it's season one where they bring in, where I get, go in the hole and all that. Yeah, where I kill, they bring in, what's his name, Michael. And he's like the guy above me and he's threatening me in the hotel room and all that. And then Owen Krevecki. Yeah, that's all season
one. Owen Krevecki. Yeah. That's season one.
Anyway, he breaks my finger and I had to wear this, like, you know, splint.
Like a splint? Yeah.
And it was on my left hand and like da-da-da-da-da-da. And then in season two, I get a hit in the head with a fire extinguisher. And I have like this, and I get burned by this crazy woman.
By an iron. Just trying to survive.
Iron on my chest. And I was in, basically in the A storyline. So I was with Lincoln and Michael a lot and Michael a lot and trying to get X, Y, and Z. And like, I healed in like an episode and a half.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, the more you work, the faster you heal. Because one, it's like nobody wants to look at a huge bump on a guy's head for like 12 episodes. Like it gets distracting. When it's like three scenes in an episode and a guy has a splint, you're like, okay. But like you'd notice that like Michael gets a scrape on his eye and then like two episodes later he's gone.
Or they cut off two of his toes and he's not limping for like, the rest of the
season. I mean, you would have given me third degree burns on my chest. Right.
Oh my God,
and like two episodes later, it's like, that's just also, it creates a problem for production because you have to match the scar and the bump and the thing. So I think the higher you up on the call, you are on the call sheet,
the faster you heal.
The faster you heal.
I kind of like this.
It kind of felt like superpower.
We were also talking during the rewatch about what it's like to get squibbed. And squibbing is when you have to, when your character is shot. And they put a little, it's like a little bit of gunpowder, a little
it's
bit
a little
of a charge.
Explosive, yeah.
The shot in
The shot in Riot Drills and Devils Part 2 is when Michael and Sarah, they're getting her out for the final time. Michael runs out of the way and then the red dot is on Kwame. The guy's on Kwame's chest and you see it from the back. You see like a hole blown in him.
And explodes. And so that has to be rigged. You're actually wired into something. So you can't go running around. And it's really scary because you know you've got this charge. You know, the stunt guys, they sit you down and they go, hey, whatever you do, you know, don't keep your face away from this because it is a charge. Yeah. Things can be weird. So your heart's going really fast. And as we were talking about this, I realized that squib is also the word in Harry Potter for somebody who can't do magic. Somebody who's a witch or a wizard who can't do magic.
Really?
Yep. A squib, but trust me, I've got a pretty thorough knowledge.
Yeah,
it's getting
more
and more fading. But I taught both my kids how to read by reading Harry Potter.
Right.
And so I've read the entire series three times, and I realized the author is problematic in many ways, but this is all before that. And so it was just a sort of funny moment where two things collided in my head. The number of times that I've been in conversations with these usually quite macho stunt coordinators. Going, we're going to squib you and you're going to do this. And, you know, they always give you the girl talk about don't be scared and whatever.
Right. The way that it works is it seems so unsophisticated when you think about it. They put a little explosion and they put a little pack of blood over it. Mm-hmm. And it blows a hole in your clothes.
But it's detonated remotely through an electrical charge.
Electrical what charge? Yeah. and it hurts.
Yeah, yeah, depending on where they put it.
And you're trying, like you said, you're wince because you know it's coming and you're not supposed to know it's coming. It's like when you ever, I don't know if you've ever, I've been slapped many times on camera. It's like after the first two, the first two are great. After that, you can't help
really?
But squint. Yeah, I mean, you know you're going to get hit.
I don't think I've ever been slapped on camera. I think I've slapped a couple people.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. I saw my wonderful close friend, Sergio Lopez Rivera, who is just an incredible guy. He was saying how it drives him crazy in movies. He can tell when couples, when people are going to kiss in a scene because he can tell that they've already kissed. Because his eye is so good.
Because there's like road rash and stuff.
Even if it's not lipstick, even if it's nothing serious.
Right.
Actors' faces that they've already kissed, and it drives him. He's like, I know they're going to kiss in this scene, which is hilarious to me.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And if someone gets slapped, if you look carefully, you're like, that person's face is red.
Yeah.
Like you can see it coming.
So maybe, hopefully, you just get the first take right and you use that.
That's right. But that never, you know, that doesn't happen.
So we also have something else from this. This is more from part one. But we flagged this to talk about. So Cherry, Teabag's little gift, who I believe plays longer in the show than these episodes. He is named Seth.
His real name?
Okay. Yeah, okay. No, his character's name is Seth. Okay. And Teabag calls him Cherry. And the reason for that, I believe, is the writer's assistant was named Seth Hoffman.
Oh.
And I know that because Seth Hoffman went to Dartmouth along with me and my friend Mark Bruni, who is he started as Jerry Zaks' assistant and is now a big, I think, theater director in New York. Cool. And Seth and Mark were roommates in LA. And at one point, shortly before Prison Break, and after Tarzan, I had come to town and I needed a place to stay. And I like crashed on their couch for a couple of nights. And then one day Seth came to set and he was like, I'm the writer's assistant. And I actually remember he had given me a spec script he wrote that was a spec episode of The West Wing. And I think he called it Virginia. And it was fantastic. But I was like, I am not in a place to give this to anybody who could ever help you. And then he ended up as the writer's assistant and they named Cherry after him. And then he ended up writing episodes.
Oh, he did?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he was with the show the whole time. He started writing episodes, I think, in season two. And then I think he went on to Walking Dead after I left that show.
Oh, wow. He's following but that's around. Is he still around?
He's still around. He's still writing. Still terrific writer. But yeah, Seth Hoffman for Cherry.
Speaking of writing, you were going to say there's this really sweet scene. It's the first time you see Sarah warm up to Michael a little bit, even though he's rescued her. You guys are in the ceiling, and it's right before he says, well, at least I'm trying. He says something about the thing that made you, it's a really beautiful moment because you kind of reluctantly warm up. You smile despite yourself, which is a great, fun thing. You know, you're really trying to not warm up to this guy. And he says, it might have been about the 50 cent beers or something. And you kind of reluctantly smile. And then he's talking about Baja. He's talking about Thailand. It's a really nice moment between the two of you. And it's the warmest we've seen him too.
Yeah.
And you guys also had genuine chemistry. But it also, it's such a great long play. And you guys are so right to push for not falling in love quickly, not kissing quickly, all that stuff is because it's just, you know, a simmering tension. And also it would stretch credulity for it, you guys to be getting it on too quickly.
Especially since she was almost just gang raped.
Right. Not now. No, I mean, even the episodes previously, but that scene is really lovely. But you mentioned that you thought Wentworth had something to do with it being Baja.
Yeah, so again, dork notes. So I'm looking through my revisions. And in the Goldenrod revision, which I believe is the last one, I'm going to read you the speech that was written for scene 32 Apple, interior crawl space day, continuous, Sarah's voice is unsteady. Because this is, I believe, what they intended for Wentworth to say. And it's really interesting that he made a different choice. When I was a kid, we lived out away from the city. Every spring, someone would spot a funnel cloud in the middle of a thunderstorm and there would be a tornado warning. So my mom would take me and my brother down to the basement and we'd all sit under the ping pong table. I was always scared, but then we'd eat popcorn and play Yahtzee and I'd forget all about the storm. I don't know why she thought we'd be safe under that crappy ping pong table, but we made it. Sarah, now more calm, looks at Michael contemplating this. Michael, why are you doing this? So,
and he was like, I have an alt. Have you ever been to Baja?
So what I have is a folded piece of white paper that I clearly printed out from my email. And I think it's also not written in final draft. I think, and this is what Michael actually said. I think he sent me, because this would happen sometimes. I think the night before he would send me what he was going to say in the scene, which is the, you know, ever been to Baja? No. They got this place down there, $20 a night, hammock on the back deck, beers 50 cents, happy hour, they're a quarter. Beat, no response. Thailand, you ever been to Thailand? Sarah, if you're trying to calm me down, you're doing a real bad job. Michael, warmly, but I am trying. There's a whole bunch of stuff there that I think is interesting, but part of it...
Good.
It's very well written. It's a real understanding of how people connect, how broken people connect in trauma. But it also, to me, is a bit of the merging of Michael and Wentworth, which is Wentworth didn't want to be seen. Mm. He didn't want to be known. He didn't want that intimacy with fans and an audience. And I think Michael ends up taking that on.
So the idea of telling you a whole story, an intimate story about his mother and a storm, that was too too revealing. Although there is something intimate, I mean, in a different, obviously not as intimate, but there is something, have you ever been to Baja? Like when he starts describing it so specifically, it obviously intimates it's a special place for him. He spent time there, etc. There's no Baja reveal later, right? You guys don't, there's no Bourne Identity or like Shawshank. You guys end up on a beach in Baja, is there?
You know, I think, and we'll see as we keep rewatching this, that somewhere in seasons, I think either two or four, there's a like, ooh, those beers on the beach in Baja are starting to sound real good right now.
Uh-huh. It is a really nice moment of connection. Of course, it does remind me of Airplane when he says Thailand, and it's like, have you ever seen a grown man naked? Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
Nope. I have no idea what you're talking about.
Okay, forget it. Older than you are. It's a reference.
I've seen Airplane. I just didn't memorize it.
So, Sarah, are you saying that he wrote that completely and then just like brought it in?
So.
And said, and like, do you think he... I wonder how Karen Usher feels about that.
Well, I mean, by season two, there was a pretty consistent sense that I had that when I got Michael and Sarah scenes, you know, I would call the writers and be like, help me understand what you want from this line. You know, I could make this come out of my mouth in this, with these words, if you're willing to let me. Like, I remember, especially Zach Estrin, for some reason, we would have these calls. I'd get scripts and we'd talk about them. And it was almost like a little mini tone meeting.
Sure.
But then I would wait for Wentworth to tell me what he was going to say because, you know, he's an astonishing writer and he had this very clear sense of Michael. And sometimes he'd send me and he'd say, this is what I'm going to say. Your response is, you know, I don't want to put words in your mouth. So you let me know what.
Do you know, and this is, you know, do you know J. August Richards? Of course you do.
Of course I do.
He asked me to go, Council of Dance? Yeah. He asked me to go on, he's doing a podcast about being a series regular. Mm-hmm. And he asked me to go on and talk about this very thing, which was what happens when you, and he wanted to hear my perspective as a actor and as a writer and someone who's showrun is what is the, how does it work when you, as an actor, when you have suggestions, when you want to suggest changes, when you have questions, and what is that? Do you know, how was that just politically for you with the powers that be, and how was it for Wendt and the powers that be? Do you remember what the dynamic was?
I can't speak to the Wendt side of it all because that was you know, he's number one on the call sheet, and this is very much his show. For me, it came from following his lead, you know, which is to say that if I'm, you know, if he's going to email me the morning we're shooting something and say, this is what I'm going to say, I got to figure out what to respond. I do remember the writers being super open, you know, I mean, in between the pilot and shooting the season, I had written this silly document about thoughts I had on Sarah. I don't trust characters who are good because I've never met anybody who's good. Everybody's got a show, everybody.
Thanks, Sarah.
Oh, I just mean...
Go out there and love everybody.
There's a reason, right? There's a reason that you put yourself in a situation like that. And from my perspective, I was like, I think she's probably atoning for something. And, you know, what if there's an addiction piece here? What if she's an alcoholic? Or what if she's an alcoholic as a means of coping with it? And I just sort of sent it to Paul and was like,
when did you present that? Tell me the timeline on that. When did you present it?
I think it was once we were picked up. And I was like, hey, I've got more deep character work.
It was early. Okay.
Yeah. And then, but I didn't realize he'd done anything with it until Brother's Keeper, which is the flashback episode where you see that, like, not only is she an alcoholic, but there's narcotics involved too.
I mean, you certainly see it in this episode, in the scene with your father, with the governor.
Yep.
There is a kind of scolding. That's not just you're trying to be a do-gooder. There's a kind of history in him saying, I told you you didn't have to do this. Like, you're putting yourself in danger. Like, it sounds very like somebody dealing with an addict in the kind of wrong way, which is shaming, et cetera. Did you have anything to do? I mean, I understand that you had already talked to Shering about that backstory, but that specific scene, do you remember having thoughts about it? It's very, it's really well written.
As far as I know, that came out fully baked.
So that's so cool. My question, I guess, is, you know, sometimes, and this is for the audience, sometimes when actors have ideas about character and lines, and I want to say this instead of this, it's not well received, and sometimes it's not presented well. I mean, it can get real nasty, and it can get real inappropriate. I think some actors are bad about the way they talk about writing. Two writers, I think they have a misunderstanding of the whole process. And I think writers can also talk to actors the wrong way and think they're just kind of like meat puppets that are supposed to say words.
Yeah, you can't change a comma.
And sometimes it's not, you know, it also is, when people ask me about it, I think it is so idiosyncratic to the project and to the people on the project. You know,
how did you handle it as a showrunner?
It was imposters. And it was, and it was certain scenes. You know, if people had ideas about the character, that was always a great thing to talk about and dig into and use what people's thoughts were or kind of disabuse them of a notion. Say, well, that's actually not what we're thinking. We're thinking this. And we'd usually come to... Sometimes it was I'm not saying it very well. Sometimes there was a kind of screwball comedy tone. And sometimes there was a quieter, darker, more intimate tone. Quieter, darker, more intimate could be very, very naturalistic.
Right,
and
right.
The screwball comedy needed a kind of rat-a-tat-tat that had to be honored. And so that was just idiosyncratic to the actors in the scene. Also, luckily, one of us was usually Adam, who was my partner. He directed a majority of the episodes, and he was the producing director. So having the creator also be the director for most of it, that was a huge tone. Was such
a huge
part of that show that was just key. And a show like this, I mean, there's a lot of characters. There's a lot of characters to service. There's a lot of storyline to service, and I could see that it would
I think some of the challenge is. I don't want to be rude, but like, I do remember at a certain point being told, you know, we don't love it when everybody changes lines because some people change things without, you know, especially as the show went on, without maybe a huge appreciation of the machination of everything else going on.
Deciding
and that's
that
the tricky thing is, you know, I think sometimes I've had actors say to me on the directing side, well, I don't think my character would do that. And part
and
of that answer
and you go like
is,
this? Actually.
Well, but your character would do that because it's in the script. So your job is to figure out
that's
who
right.
the character is who does that.
That's right.
And it is a tough balance. It's a really tough balance.
And I think it cuts the other way too. I think there are some writers that just don't want to hear it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think they're a writer, it could be the greatest idea in the world. And they're like, you're an actor. I'm a writer. This is inappropriate. This is inappropriate.
For sure.
I heard a story about, I've been in writers' rooms where they'll invite, you know, actors, the lead in to say, here's what we're thinking for the season. And do you have any ideas? And that can be really interesting. And I think, I wish every actor could spend a week in a writer's room. I think it would be so, because you get a script sometimes and you're like, well, how did they get from A to B? And why do we have to do this instead of this?
That's
and
a great idea.
There's a lot of actors sitting around going, this is stupid, which I get, because sometimes it is. But sometimes knowing how you got there is important. I also think I think every writer should have to spend a day or two or an episode with an actor and seeing, this script change means this for me. And then I just think there's so many gears at work and there's so much balkanization between what everyone's doing that the integration can be really important. But I remember, you know, some actors are not interested. Like I heard a story, I have a friend that worked on Shameless for years and years and years, and they had William Macy in at the beginning of a season, and like they gave him a whole pitch for the entire season. I don't know if I'm telling tales out of school, but whatever. And then they were like, do you have any ideas for the season? And he was like, he had thought like long and hard about what they had said. It's like, you know, 45-minute thing. And he was like, yeah, maybe he can wear a hat at some point. And they're like, okay, great. And he's like, great. Can't wait, you guys. Like, and it wasn't like, he was just kind of like,
your job, I'll do mine.
I mean, you know, he's like a mammoth actor. Like, he's like, give me the words and I say the words. And
yeah.
I also remember hearing a really smart thing that Viola Davis said, which was, you know, in theaters, there is a Bible there. And everything you need to learn, you figure out during rehearsal and with the dramaturg, with the writer, if the writer's around, with the director. And in TV and film, a lot of your job is filling in the blanks. I mean, where did I come from? How did this happen? Blah, 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 blah. And it doesn't have to, the writers don't have to know about it. It doesn't matter. It's your job, like you said, to figure out why is my character doing A and then B. If there's a real disconnect, obviously you have a problem. You need to get it solved. But it is your job to figure out who this person is. If you decide, though, for instance, I decided Kellerman was Secret Service via Special Forces. That was just something I decided. I wanted a Special Forces pin. I did all this research. It was very helpful. There was not very much literature on Secret Service. There was a lot on Special Forces. It just informed a kind of military mentality for me. If for some reason in episode 10, they had said he was Coast Guard and that there was a plot point that he was Coast Guard, he came from a Coast Guard family and da-da-da-da-da, and they decided that halfway through the season, as like Viola said, if you decide you're from Florida and that's a huge part of your character, and then there's a huge thing that they're from Texas, then you're from Texas.
Yeah, you got to make that change.
You have to make that change. And I think one of the really interesting acting insights there is it doesn't really matter to the audience as long as you are specific.
The specificity matters, but the details of the specificity.
You know, so that informs you being able to be a full human, but it doesn't, it ends up in the performance, but nobody really knows why. So if it changes, it's okay.
It's also the difference, I think, between writing for television and writing for theater, which is that in theater, you know, the script is the Bible, partly because the beginning, middle, and end will not change.
Well,
this is the story that you're telling, whereas often, I mean, we all got the script for Brother's Keeper and we're like, oh.
Right.
You know, I mean, I didn't know that Bellick and I went back to an AA meeting and he asked me out and I told him no.
Right.
And there's nothing you can do about what's past, but then you start playing that going forward.
You said, and I think sorry, go ahead.
What's that? No, please.
You said Riot Drills in the Devil Part One. You said, oh, I bet that was the first time they heard about this backstory. I can't remember which character it was.
But I think that was in the scene between Sarah and Bellick. And I was like, oh, we didn't know in this scene that we
no,
had
this
backstory.
No, it was something else. No? It was somebody. It wasn't one of us. It was somebody else. And you said, oh, I bet that's the first they heard that.
Oh, was remember. That the teabag finding out that his father had raped his
sister? Yes. Oh, it was that.
Sister?
It was exactly that. He's like, I'll bet that wasn't in the... I mean, I bet they didn't say to him...
No.
Well, yeah. Well, I bet they didn't say, oh, and he's, you know, he's the
product of incest.
And like, you know, I mean, maybe...
No, you get those scripts.
Maybe never
like,
came up with that. And oh. Yeah, you go, oh, okay, yeah. Well, maybe I wish I had known that. But also, it's fascinating because kind of... I think maybe TV, film, obviously it changes a lot and there is a lot of times a backstory that you have to fill in because it's just not what the film is doing. Sometimes it changes halfway through. But TV is the only medium that you play the same character for years.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes longer than the writers are around.
Longer than the writers are around. And that's the only thing where you're going to find things out where you've been playing somebody for 3 years mm-hmm. and then you find out, oh, they actually, you know, had a sibling that died or da-da-da-da. And that is very particular to television, to acting on television.
Well, and it also does sometimes mean that we have to be, because the wheels of television move so quickly, sometimes we have to be stewards of our characters.
100%.
In different ways. I mean, and this is slightly different, but when we went back to season 5, mm-hmm. which was all those years after the show had aired. Mm-hmm. We had a different writer's room. Mm-hmm. And when I got the first script, there was a, you know, Sarah and Jacob are having a glass of wine at the end of the night. And I called up and I was like, so just FYI, it's a real big plot point that Sarah's an alcoholic. So I'm just trying to understand, is this sliding into a relapse? And they were like, nope, sorry, just... It's been a super long time. We've got different writers. Just slipped through the cracks. And so I think sometimes when actors advocate on their behalf, on their character's behalf, it is because sometimes a character needs to go from A to P, and somewhere around G-H-I-J, the writers might have something else in the foreground of their mind. And some of those character details can get a little bit skipped. Moving on, I do want to say in our rewatch, we also came up with another drinking game.
Yeah, which was?
Which is probably specific to people who listen to our watch party with us. But every time, not every time, but most of the time, when an actor steps into frame, who is a Chicago local hire, Paul will go... Oh, that's so-and-so from such-and-such, and they created this theater company and won this award, and this is the role that they played. Well, so I have decided, for anybody who wants to join us on the rewatch
party, go back to the pilot and get real drunk.
You can, yeah. I mean, I would drink something very low alcohol by volume. I would
suggest I think casting, you know, there's only, well, there actually, it's a very deep bench.
No, it goes on and on and on and on and on and on. And Claire Simon cast the living daylights.
She really did. I started acting in Chicago professionally when I was 20. And I think we started Prison Break when I was 35. So.
A 15-year bench.
Yeah, that's a long bench.
15-year bench. So that's rule one. Rule two is, this is the Kellerman drinking game. Or no, the Edelstein drinking game. So you drink whenever Paul knows somebody and identifies them correctly from Chicago. And then you drink every time Kellerman kills someone. I suggest spritzers.
Yeah, because it's
going to go low alcohol. Because
the body count is going to rise. Let's take a quick break and then we'll come back and we'll answer some fan questions. Let's get to some fan questions.
Oh, yes.
Can we start?
What do we have here? Yeah, totally.
Oh. Mary LaFoyason at Visual Mind 1 asks, first of all, she says, I love the two parts of Riot Drills and the Devil, and asks, what was the most intense scene for you guys to watch? And I would say, I don't like seeing you. That there was some of. I was glad that I was watching this with you. It's very upsetting to see you in such peril.
Yeah, the licking the face.
Hard to watch.
Hard to watch. Yeah, I mean those guys, those actors were really lovely, but
someone's still licking your face.
But the threat of all that stuff which I think also answers Steph Lista's question.
Yes, what was the hardest scene to film? What was the hardest scene to film? What's the hardest scene to film?
Yeah.
Ali Reaser?
Yeah, I mean, the stuff is big.
How do you prepare the first scene? How do you prepare to get into that headspace? Sometimes I forget it's a show. The act is incredible. I agree, you're incredible in it. How do you sustain, I'll make it a more specific question, that level of fear I was talking about when you guys are, it's really hard. I find it really hard to play and sustain because fear is exhausting. You know, your body
there's tension.
An actor said, acting teacher said, you know, your body doesn't know you're acting. So
it doesn't know the difference. The
adrenaline and the cortisol and all that stuff is real. Yeah. How did you sustain, those are long scenes to shoot. Do you remember how you got there and do you remember how you stayed there?
Well, I think it's an interesting question. It's been a while, but I think it's very difficult to play fear. I think it's more, and this is kind of a John Barton thing. John Barton used to say that American actors try and have emotions and British actors try and handle their emotions. The difference being you don't play that you're afraid, you play a bunch of actions. I can cope with this. I can push this down. I can control this situation. I can stab this guy in the arm. Mm-hmm. I can put out this phone book. I can save myself. And the futility of that, the failure starts to creep in, right? So the fear is the failure of all of the actions that you're taking to save yourself. And in we're oppositional creatures, right? So that for some reason, the farther you push the fear down, the more it starts leaking out, I think, around the corners.
That is a great acting, you know.
Well, and it's then, also not, I mean, look, if you're a woman on a set surrounded by big dudes screaming at you, it's not like, that's such a daily walk around fear for most women. Mm-hmm. Like it's not, you know, and again, like most of us, I've been sexually assaulted. I think in some ways, part of the challenge of the scenes was keeping my own experience sufficiently at arm's length that I could like do the job and not get sort of swallowed up in. I actually find that sometimes things that touch me too personally are very hard for me to work with because you just shut down emotionally instead of being able to kind of move through stuff. And so, you know, the guys did a great job and the directors did a great job. They kept them going. So even in the shots that were just on me, they didn't say, oh, for the shot, for the sake of audio, let's stand them down. You play scared.
Good.
The directors kept them pounding on the windows and screaming and all that threat so that all you've got to do is really listen to what's happening. I think.
It's really effective. I think we're running out of time. We really have to have guests because we will just talk about acting like dorks forever.
It is what we do, to be fair. But yeah.
Sure. I thought we were podcasters.
Thank you for listening with us, everyone.
Thank you for listening. Thank you for your wonderful questions. Please keep going to Prison Break Podcast at Prison Break Podcast on Instagram.
Leave us your questions. They're great.
Leave us your questions. Send us some fan art. We cannot wait to watch the next episode together. And I think that's it, Sarah. Anything else?
Yeah. I mean, hey, don't go to prison. And if you do, keep your pants on. Or your trousers. Keep your trousers on.
Definitely keep your trousers on.
Bye, everybody.
Bye, everybody.
Prison Breaking with Sarah and Paul is a Caliber Studio production. Your hosts have been friends, but not besties, Sarah Wayne Callies and Paul Edelstein. Our prison warden has been producer Ben Haber. Our head of Jailhouse Rock is Paul Edelstein, who made the music for this podcast. Keeping us slim and trim in the prison yard has been sound designer and editor, the great Jeff Schmidt. Keeping us up to date on the outside world is production assistant Drew Austin. Our prison artist, logo, and brand designer is John Nunziato and Little Big Brands. Check them out at www.littlebigbrands.com. Follow us on Instagram at Prison Break Podcast. Email us at prisonbreaking@caliber-studio.com and call us at 401-3-PBREAK. Prison Breaking with Sarah and Paul has been a Caliber Studio production. Thank you for listening.